Hello and welcome to Talking Aussie Books, a new weekly podcast shining a spotlight on Australian fiction. My name is Claudine Tennellis. As a writer and avid reader, I love chatting about books. And in this podcast, I'll chat to authors, publishers and readers, giving you, dear listener, insight into what's hot on the Australian fiction scene. So if you're looking for your next book recommendation or just want to know more about Aussie fiction writers, this podcast is for you. Grab yourself a cuppa, sit back and enjoy. Amanda Hampson is an Australian author who has been writing professionally for more than 20 years. She has written two non-fiction books, a swag of articles and six novels. Her latest novel, Lovebirds, was released by Penguin in early May of this year, a heartwarming and also heartbreaking story about the power of love and family that sensitively deals with a number of heavy themes. It was the first of Amanda's novels that I've read, and I'm now itching to go through her backlist, titles that include The Olive Sisters, Two for the Road, The French Perfumer, The Yellow Villa, and 60 Summers. And so it is with enormous pleasure that I welcome Amanda to the podcast today. Hi, Amanda.
Hi, Claudine. Thank you so much for having me.
I loved this story.
Oh, that's good. That's good to hear.
Tell me, what's the feedback you're getting about Elizabeth and her story?
Well, I've had very positive feedback so far. She said that cautiously because you never know what's going to happen on Goodreads. Somebody takes umbrage. But so far, actually, the Goodreads rating is the highest of any of my books. Yeah, just beautiful feedback from people, just very touched by the themes, and particularly for younger people who are not aware of some of the historic times that where we go, we have the current day where we see Elizabeth is a little bit out of sorts with a lot of people and got offside with her daughter-in-law, and she takes her grandson Zach on this road trip. Her 15-year-old grandson is the current day. But when we go back to the formative times of her life, these are times that are very familiar for people of my generation, the, dare I say, baby boomers. But for younger people, it's actually, my feedback has been that it's quite a revelation as to some of the things that happened that did change her life and the direction of her life.
Yeah, now I want to go on and explore some of those events. But for those who haven't had the pleasure of reading this book as I have, I was wondering if you could tell me more about it.
I'll just go back for a moment to my sort of inspiration behind it, and then I'll explain the plot a little bit. I suppose I have been thinking about this book for about 10 years, on and off, and I had the idea for Elizabeth sort of inspired by the fact that, you know, when we're young, we think we'll always be young and old people were always old and not very interesting. And when you become older, and I'm in my mid-60s, you actually have this realisation of how interesting and what varied lives the people around you of your generation have had. At a time that we've become quite invisible and seen as one-dimensional, I suppose. So I thought it'd be interesting to take this character on a contemporary journey. And, of course, it's, you know, when you get a woman in her late 60s, as Elizabeth is, with a 15-year-old boy, there's just so much potential for humour. You don't know where to start. But I also wanted to show this is how she became the person that she is now. So when you meet her in the first couple of chapters, you see her as quite a prickly character that the reader's probably wondering, oh, I don't know if I like this character. I don't know if I can empathise with her. But then we go back in time. So we first meet her at her best friend's funeral, and then we go back and we meet her when the two girls met at 10. And see the depth of their friendship. And then we go, you know, we're going through the 60s and where she meets Ray, who becomes the love of her life, and then the things that happen to them in their life. And in the meantime, we, you know, Zach and she go on this road trip. So it was to get these kind of different dimensions of an every woman, I suppose, of our generation that I really was aiming for. And of course the wild card in there is her best buddy Eric, who is proving to be the star of the show. People are saying, oh, I just love Eric. So I should say that Eric is her budgie, and he has a lot of things to say for himself, and they're pretty much always unexpected and sometimes inappropriate, would it be fair to say?
Thank you for that. I confess that I was a tad confused in the first page and a half of this story. I hadn't read the back cover when I picked it up, and I didn't realise that Eric was a budgie. And I laughed out loud once the penny dropped. I think it was like the second page, halfway down. I was like, oh, for goodness sake.
Yes, well, that was very intentional. I was actually trying to, I thought I can probably go for two pages, getting the reader to imagine that she has this very quiet, stoic husband in the background. And that, because I thought if you go for too long, you get a situation where you go, oh, I didn't realize, you know, I didn't realize that was a budgie, but there's sort of a real timing and a knack in the timing that you, you're assuming one thing and you find it's something completely different.
It also made me sad to learn that despite the full life Elizabeth had lived, marriage, children, etc., that she was now alone, estranged from her family, and that her closest friend was indeed Eric the talkative budgie.
Yes, well, you know, a lot of women are alone at this age with varying degrees of happiness and success. I live alone. I don't have a budgie. And I think living alone is absolutely splendid. But then I was in relationships from a very, very young age. So I was in relationships for many, many, many years. And so now I live a life like somebody in their 20s. I have children. I have the work that I want. Everything's perfect. But it does give me an insight into how it is for women to live alone, and many women I know don't want to live alone. It's not what they expected for themselves at all, particularly if they've had family or had children. So I wanted to explore that with Elizabeth, but this might sound a bit like writerly manipulation. I didn't want her to be entirely alone. So I thought, who, you know, because it's not very good to have a character just wandering around the house chatting to the cutlery or whatever, which we do. I thought, okay, would she have a cat? Would she have a dog? And then when I came up with the idea of the budgie, I thought, oh, the budgie's just the perfect kind of sounding board for her, very companionable and talks. So then it often happens that you put a character on the page and they take on a life of their own, and they can be very difficult to control. And Eric is one such character.
Now, early in the novel, Elizabeth answers the question about whether or not she's still working. And she says something along the lines of, I'm only 67, not sure how I feel about being asked if I'm still doing things, as if she has one foot in the grave. Do you think that this is the way society perceives women beyond childbearing ages, that if they're not raising a family and working, then they're kind of past their use by date?
Oh, absolutely. And I think the other thing is just assuming that you don't work. That's what drives me crazy. I had a couple of experiences back to back. One, I went to my local doctor that I've been to for years, and there's a new doctor there. And she said, oh, I'm just going to, she was a 40-something woman, I'm just going to update your records, and checking address and phone number and occupation, retired. And she typed in retired. And I said, I don't like people assuming that I'm retired. I actually have a profession. She said, oh, bloody da.
Zero there.
I know, like, poof. It's a silly old thing. And I was like, okay, I'm not going back to you. She will actually understand, probably in 20 years' time, what I'm talking about. And the other incident was when I was here working, and I had a young tradesman working here for a couple of days, and I just kept on, you know, on the computer. And then he sort of wandered up and said, so what did you used to do? And I just leapt off my seat. I said, listen, buddy, I didn't used to do anything. I'm doing it now. He was like, oh, I was just asking. I said, but you need to think about the way you asked it. I didn't used to do things. So I was just hypersensitive at that time to being written off. And, of course, all of these things that press your buttons are actually fantastic fodder for the author, because if I'm hearing these things, so are many other women. And some women, you know, they don't have a profession or they are retired, but you need to ask, what sort of work do you do? Or think about, you know, if I'd said to that doctor, what did you used to do? She would have been very annoyed.
One of the themes that you explored in this novel was the post-traumatic stress that Ray suffered from his time as a conscript in Vietnam. the long-term effects of this on Ray and, by extension, Elizabeth and their sons was tragic. What kind of research did you do to bring Ray's experiences to the page?
When I was a teenager, the Vietnam War was absolutely hanging over our generation. So Elizabeth is a little bit older than me because this all started to be tied up at around about 1970-71. But the boys, let's say, of my generation were dreading that time when they would hit the age that their number could come up and they could be conscripted to Vietnam. So I had the sensibility of what it was like at that time, and of course had followed the news and things over the years. But now we have all these wonderful resources, and I was able to watch videos online. I read, probably, even though we don't actually go to Vietnam or have any specific information about what Ray suffered, I read probably, I think, 5 books that I have credited in the back, talked to a couple of Vietnam vets, and came to understand that everybody that went there was affected. You know, even if you didn't see action, it was the dread, the noise, the conditions. People, particularly conscripts, were ripped out of their life, sent there, and then came back and were so vilified by the general public. It was a very, very unfair, well, it's a lot of unfair periods of history, but that particularly was one that I connected with. So I wanted to show the enormous potential that Ray had before he was conscripted. He's just interested in everything. He wants to accomplish things. He wants to travel to places. And so that we have this contrast, and like a lot of young men, of this man that went there and just had an experience that he never really got over.
You know, they didn't really have a choice, did they?
No. Apart from running away, leaving the country, if your number came up and you were conscripted and you, let's say you ran away somewhere in Australia and you were caught, you go to prison. So, yeah, no choice at all. And I think, you know, some of the people that I talked to who did escape conscription still feel, even now, a bit guilty about that. I mean, they're relieved that they didn't go through it, but they also know people whose lives were completely screwed up by it. And so they sort of feel like the kid who wags school the day it burnt down. They just feel a bit odd about it, I think.
Something I loved about Elizabeth was this desire to identify a song that sums up her life. She struggles to do this, and then it got me thinking about whether one song could adequately sum up my life, and I didn't think I could do it either. Could you?
No, and I've been asked this in a few interviews, and I come up with a different song every time, so I've had a bit of latitude with that. I guess that was just for me a metaphor for Elizabeth finding some new theme for her life. Her work has gone, her children have grown, her, you know, the everything that she's done in her life has sort of come plateaued. And so it's really about her, yeah, finding this new theme. And that metaphor is closed up on the last page of that story. It comes together. And you sort of, if you read it, you wouldn't know the significance of it. But when you have seen the song coming through, you understand the significance. To some degree, it is a cause of humour in that the songs that various people come up with are either typical or strange choices. It's those little threads that kind of make it fun and get the reader thinking about exactly those themes.
In her quest to save Zach from ending up in the prison or juvenile detention system, Elizabeth had some interesting things to say about the way the system deals with young offenders and about breaking the cycle. Is this something you also wanted to explore, and why?
I feel very strongly that young people are often written off very early. I hear, you know, parents complaining about young people in front of them. Oh, he mumbles, he never speaks, da 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 da. As if they're always going to be like that. Now, I remember with great clarity being 15 or 16, and I was a difficult to control teenager. And in fact, I remember once overhearing my mother say to my father, "Harold, do something, I can't control her." and feeling this great sense of liberation and victory that I was winning. There's a lot of potential, but it's kind of unfocused and fermenting. And I feel that kids that do stupid, reckless things because you've got no common sense end up in the justice system where they shouldn't be. You know, there needs to be these supports for them and some direction and some support. So the second thing I'll say is that it's a kind of a cheaty thing that authors do, is that I always try to find a profession for my characters when I know I have a really good source of information about that profession. Because unless you've done that work, you really need to be able to spend a lot of time talking to somebody about it, to have them read the manuscript, to get all that information, to make it authentic. So my sister-in-law, that's been her whole career. So as I started to think this, you know, this would work in really well with the fact that Zach has now got trouble, police trouble, and he is on the cusp of going into the system that Elizabeth used to work in. So there was a little bit of synchronicity there. And I was able to get all that the information that I needed to make those two parts of the story work together. So that gave Elizabeth the strength and the motivation to step into that situation and take control of it.
Yeah, absolutely. So well done. Now, as mentioned, you've dealt with some very hard-hitting issues here, but as readers, we weren't clobbered over the head with these messages, and I wondered how you managed to keep such a light touch whilst writing these scenes.
Oh, I probably just have a very dark sense of humour. Look, I think my dad is from the north of England, from Liverpool, and I think it's just in the DNA of coming from generations. And so my mother's side of the family were Irish, and there is a certain sort of sensibility and sense of humour in my DNA that says, okay, even when things are absolutely drastic, there might be a glimmer of humour there that you can reach for to kind of try and normalise the situation, if that makes any sense. You know, what I'm writing is uplifting fiction. So I want to have characters and situations that are very authentic and believable, because none of us are spending our lives skipping through the daisies without anything bad happening to us. But I don't want to plunge people into despair and darkness, absolutely not, because, you know, these are the books that I start reading and think, I'm just dreading picking that book up, because I don't want to hear about some of these things that are in the paper every day. So, yes, I write to be entertaining, to engage, and so it's not part of my charter to belt people over the head with anything, particularly anything dark.
If there was one message that you would like readers to take away from this novel, what would it be?
Well, look, it sounds a bit of a cliche, but I've been through some really difficult times in my life. And I try to look at them very much as chapters. And I think if we understand, I know that that is a cliche metaphor, but I think if we understand that chapters in our life close and new ones open, we are not going to be so resistant to change. You know, where I see people of my generation come unstuck is they are clinging to the wreckage of what was. And not saying, okay, that's over, that marriage is over, or we have to leave that house, or we have to leave that country, or these other things have happened beyond our control. What's next? Because that is an incredibly liberating and exciting adventure, finding what's next. But you need to develop that mindset. And so that's really the journey that I've taken Elizabeth on.
Amanda, it's no secret that you came to fiction writing later in your life. And I read an article that you wrote for The Guardian recently and was fascinated to learn more about your journey to publication. But the standout line for me in this article was when you said something along the lines of, the more wonderful books you read, the more intimidating it is to start writing. And I think as an aspiring writer myself, reading so many brilliant novels, especially ones like yours and by debut writers, this really resonated with me. So I wondered, can you tell me more about that and how you overcame that fear?
Well, I think if you're looking at the books you're reading as something that you can learn from, that again is a different mindset. So how did the writer affect that? How did they, you know, you can actually, if you have a writer you absolutely love, and it doesn't matter who it is, you can actually take a page or two pages and copy it out in handwriting. Because I didn't go to university, I left school at 16 and have taught myself, these are things, I remember once copying out a whole chapter of Jack Kerouac's On the Road, because that was written in a particular way and I wanted to find out how he did that, how he created the effect that he did. And if you write it out yourself, you'll be able to see it. It's a little bit like listening to music. And I don't know much about music, but I imagine that you can listen to it in different ways where you can actually hear the layering of the music. Probably similar thing in painting. You know, if you were to see a painting being affected, you know, you would be able to say, okay, well, that's how that works. So you can do the same thing by breaking down writing. And I think the more wonderful books you read, the better. It's all going into the great heaving compost pit of the writer's mind from which beautiful little things sprout and they come up when you need them.
Ned, not only have you written 6 novels, but you also run writing workshops. So I wondered if you had any other advice to offer aspiring writers out there.
Well, look, it's a boring old piece of advice, but you've just got to put your bottom on the seat and write every day. It's just the problem is, and I've experienced myself on the book that I'm working on now, is that if you don't work on it every single day, it's very hard to continue the voices, you know, the consistency of the voices, to keep it in your mind. I mean, this morning, as soon as I woke up, I started to work on the chapter that I'm writing at the moment. And then I had to walk down to my local shops. And on the way, I'm thinking, oh, no, actually, I'll take that piece of dialogue from the top and I'll put it in the end and I'll put it. It's like it, I'm seeing the screen in front of me. And I'll put it in and I'll add it into that sentence there. And then I, you know, sort of say it in my head and that works much better. And then I'll come home and do it. So if you don't do it for 3 days or a week, you're not going to have that sort of magic happen when you're not at the keyboard. And it doesn't seem like, you know, if you can write 500 words a day, it doesn't seem like an awful lot, but it builds up. It builds up, it builds up. And then you've got a draft. And then the writing starts, then you start smoothing it out and the humour comes in. All of those things come in later after you've got that those words on the page.
Amanda, you mentioned you were working on something else at the moment. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yes, I can. So I've decided that I would like to write a bit of a whodunit. So I'm committed to writing about older women now, older protagonists, which I kind of always have. And so I've set it in 1965 in Surrey Hills in the garment industry. And it's about 4 tea ladies who get together to solve a crime. There's a lot of biscuits in it. A lot of tea, a lot of biscuits, humour, bit of a whodunit. In fact, I've just been in touch with Arnott's Biscuits and they have sent me a price list of all their biscuits from 1967. The things you get when you ask.
Indeed. Well, I wish you luck with that and I can't wait to hear more about it.
Thank you.
So, Amanda, if listeners wanted to find out more about you and your books, where could they do that?
They can just Google Amanda Hampson. It's all over the internet.
Ask and you shall receive.
Exactly.
Amanda, I thoroughly enjoyed reading Lovebirds and I can't wait to dive into some more of your other titles. Congratulations once again and thank you for joining me on Talking Aussie Books.
Thanks for having me, Claudine.
Well, that's a wrap, folks. If you enjoyed this podcast, please leave a review on iTunes or drop me a line via my Instagram at Claudine Tennellis or on my webpage, claudinetennellis.com. Thanks for listening. Until next time, happy reading.